All right, I'll become a Christian if you prove to me that it's all true. Ever heard anybody say that? I've had it quite a few times over the years. It's what you might call conditional faith. I'll believe if. There are several sorts of proof that, generally speaking, people are demanding when they say something like that. Sometimes they're asking for some kind of intellectual proof, some kind of rational argument that will convince them. I'll believe if you can demonstrate the truth of Christianity to me with the rigor of scientific logic. But that's pretty rare, I find. Far more often, people are really looking for a rather less intellectual, more experiential, less cerebral, more supernatural, maybe, proof. A miracle, for instance. Now, that would please a lot of people. It was rather like that in Jesus' home area of Galilee. Maybe it was a little bit because they were a fairly rustic and uneducated lot up there in Galilee, farmers and fishermen mostly, and I suspect a little bit suspicious of ivory tower academics. Well, who could blame them? Lucid demonstrations of logic and exhibitions of philosophical debate meant very little to them. But a miracle, now that was different. Oh, yes, we'll believe if you prove it by working a supernatural sign, Jesus. That was the sort of conditional faith he often found up in Galilee, his own area. We read quite often, the rural masses there followed him because of the miraculous signs he performed. Now, you might think that Jesus would be very happy about that. Certainly there are a lot of Christians, and always have been, who think that attracting tens of thousands of people to, say, Lourdes, or a healing crusade in Wembley Stadium, or something like that, ranks as a considerable spiritual success. The interesting thing is, you don't have to examine the Gospels much before you realize that Jesus' attitude to this kind of popular enthusiasm generated because of his miracles was not an attitude of unqualified approval. The evangelist John has a particular interest, actually, in examining this subject of miraculous signs and people's reaction to them and what they could and could not achieve. He tells us that one of the reasons he wrote his gospel was in order to tell people about the miraculous signs, to record them in the book, so that they might believe Jesus was the Son of God. So he's clearly not against the miraculous supernatural element in Jesus' ministry. He clearly believes it has evidential power. And yet very often in John's Gospel you come across, as in John 4:48, if you want an actual reference, Jesus there, strangely equivocal, complaining in rather disappointed tones about the way the people won't believe unless they see miraculous signs. And he's speaking about his own Galilean fellow countrymen when he says that. The same is true of the other Gospels, true, too. The other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are all keen to record the miracles of Jesus. They clearly feel that such stories are an important substantiation of Jesus' identity as the Messiah. And yet again, the strange thing is that when you look closely at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the many miraculous stories about Jesus that they tell, I don't think you can really find one miracle which was actually performed by Jesus with the design of producing faith in others. Rather, in every case, the miracles are themselves a response to a faith that already has been declared. So you find things said like, Jesus couldn't do many miracles there because of their unbelief. Not a case of, he did many miracles there to make them believe, but he couldn't do many miracles there because of their unbelief. As if their unbelief made miracles redundant. Now, Matthew 8, this passage we come to tonight, is rather interesting in that connection. There are three miracles, or specific miracles, recorded here, together with a general statement about a lot of others. Clearly these three, the healing of the leper in verses 1 to 4, the healing of the centurion's servant in verses 5 to 13, and the very briefly recorded healing of Peter's mother-in-law in verses 14 to 15, these have clearly been selected. For we read in verse 16, there were many such stories that could be told about Jesus. For that evening, many who were demon-possessed and who were sick were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits and healed them. So why does Matthew fasten on these three? Well, I think it's because they illustrate particularly well the nature of the faith Jesus sought in his followers. Faith for Jesus was always a response, a very personal response to him. That's what he was looking for. And these three stories elucidate that response of faith in a very clear way. And the interesting thing is that in every case, the faith comes before the miracle. There are three characteristics of this faith I'd like you to identify with me as we review those three stories, as we survey them tonight. I want you, first of all, to notice that in every case, the faith that is manifested in these three stories involves an acknowledgement of personal powerlessness and helplessness. The second thing I think I want you to notice, which they have in common, is that each expression of faith is a demonstration of humble confidence in the power of Jesus. And the third thing I want you to notice is that each example of faith issues in an active response of service and testimony. I suspect that when the early preachers of the gospel used these stories of Matthew, those were exactly the sorts of points that they wanted people to discover within them, and we shall do the same tonight. All right, let's start with this observation that in each case, the faith that is expressed involves an acknowledgement of personal powerlessness. If you just scan down these three case studies, the leper, the centurion servant, and Peter's mother-in-law, you will, I think, realize, at least if you know anything about the culture of the Near East 2,000 years ago, you'll discover that all of these three were socially disadvantaged in one way or another. Take the leper, for instance. We even use that word as a metaphor today, don't we? It hangs over for somebody who is shunned by society, an outcast. Well, lepers in Jesus' day were treated just like that. They were loathed and detested. Can you imagine what it must have been like to have to go through the countryside or through a village shouting out, "Unclean! Unclean!" and even ringing a bell to warn people you were on the way. Can you imagine what it must have felt like when you approached a crowd of people to see them parting with looks of disgust and horror on their face, all of them trying to keep at least 6 foot away from you because that's what the law said they had to do. And if they could, they'd have made it 12 feet. Can you imagine what it was like never to be able to visit a city because you just weren't allowed within inside the city walls? You were out in the country or in very, very small villages. You never entered anything bigger. It was a terrible, terrible plight to be in, to be a leper. As for this centurion, he was socially disadvantaged, not by virtue of this horrifying disease, but because of his race. See, a centurion was a Roman soldier. That meant, first of all, he was a Gentile. And the Jews in the first century kept a very large distance between themselves and Gentiles. They regarded Gentiles as unclean too. But worse than being a Gentile, the centurion was an officer of the Roman army, an occupying imperialist army detested by the Jewish people. And down in Jerusalem, I guess, where there are rather more Romans around, and where maybe some of the Jews, for their own self-interest's sake, were rather more interested in befriending, or at least having some kind of business dealings with Gentiles, he might have felt that life was socially tolerable. But up in Galilee, to be stationed up in Galilee must have been an absolute nightmare for a Roman centurion, because Galilee was an absolute hotbed of anti-Roman terrorist activity. Everybody loathed and detested the Romans up in Galilee. So he was socially disadvantaged too. Wherever he went, people turned their back on him. And even poor old Peter's mother-in-law, you know, in her own way, would have been a socially disadvantaged person in the first century, because, of course, she was a woman. Now, it is actually very hard for us to imagine just how difficult life was for the female sex in the first century. I know some ladies like to say life is very hard for them today, and with a measure of justice sometimes, but it was far, far worse in this patriarchal Judaistic society of the first century. Women were quite commonly regarded as educationally subnormal by Jewish males. Ineducable. There was no point, really, in trying to teach them anything. They weren't on the earth to learn. They were simply on the earth to have children. In fact, it was not uncommon for a pious Jew to give thanks in his daily prayers that God had not made him a Samaritan, a Gentile, or a woman. So I suspect Peter's mother-in-law quite often felt like she wasn't a first-class citizen. In all these ways, then, the leper, the centurion, and Peter's mother-in-law, they're all socially disadvantaged people. For that reason alone, there's a certain powerlessness about them. But beyond their social disadvantage, of course, they all have in common the fact that they are sick. The leper, very seriously so. The centurion, not personally so. It's his servant we're talking about, who's in the grip of some agonizing paralysis. And Peter's mother-in-law has a fever, most likely malaria, but it could have been several other fevers. Now, the thing you have to realize about sickness in the first century was that it was feared. In fact, sickness has been feared all over the world until comparatively recently. We take the advances of modern medicine so much for granted. When we get sick these days, we expect to get well. We even feel rather cheated when the doctor says, "I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do for you." It's a devastating blow. We don't expect doctors to say things like that. We expect them to give us some medicine or to prescribe an operation, and we get better. But that expectation is a very, very modern one. Illness was feared in the ancient world. What's more, in the ancient Jewish world, sickness carried with it a social stigma. For it was very widely believed among Jewish people that sickness was the result of sin. You even catch, actually, the hint of that, the reflection of that, in verse 17 of this very passage, the last verse we read. "This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases." Now that text that Matthew is quoting there is actually from Isaiah chapter 53, the same chapter that was read to us a little earlier on. In that chapter, Isaiah is predicting that the servant of God, when he comes, will bear the punishment for the sins of God's people. But in the context of predicting that, he also says, "He will take up our infirmities and carry our diseases." Now, it could be that that's just a metaphor, that sin is seen as an infirmity of the soul, as sickness is seen as an infirmity of the body. But it's much more likely that Isaiah sees the matter in a more direct way than that. And I think Matthew certainly understands him that way. That sin and sickness are related. Illness is in this world because of sin. Because we human beings have departed from God's way, there has been a fundamental disjunction in the smooth running of the universe. And one of the results of that is that we human beings fall ill. And whilst the Bible refuses to individualize that consequence of the sinfulness of human beings, it refuses to say, well, just because this particular individual is sick, he or she must be a particularly bad sinner. It refuses to do that. It even admits that someone like righteous Job gets sick, and he doesn't deserve it at all. Though the Bible refuses to individualize the connection between sin and sickness, the Bible does insist it is there. And that theological connection in the Jewish mind brought with sickness, therefore, an element of shame, of social stigma. So this company of people that we are reading about in the first part of Matthew 8 are socially disadvantaged and stigmatized, and they are quite unable to help themselves in that situation. They have got a big problem on their hands. Now, how do they respond to the situation? I suppose any of them could have reacted with cynicism. They could have allowed their misfortune to breed bitterness in their hearts. The leper might have sulked in his leper colony, inwardly enraged by the injustice of his plight. The centurion might have shrugged his shoulders with indifference. Oh, well, what's a servant? You can pick them up to a penny. The interesting thing, the important thing about these three, the reason Matthew the Evangelist wants us to look at them particularly, is because that this leper, this centurion, brought their problem to Jesus. In the midst of this condition of helplessness and powerlessness, they brought their problem to Jesus. That is always the beginning of faith. Faith, at its very essence, is an admission of our own personal helplessness. If we do not feel personally helpless, we cannot exercise faith as the Bible understands it. It's a good question, therefore, to put to ourselves tonight, isn't it? Do we feel inwardly helpless? One of the problems, of course, of being a student at Cambridge University is that very few of us do. Oh, I do agree that when finals come around, you see a few heads sort of bowed in desperation on a Sunday morning, and you think that maybe their prayer life has been served. But by and large, most people who get to this university have been very successful. They've passed all their exams. In fact, they've not just passed them, they've done very well in them. And that sort of thing can go to your head, you know. It can make you think that you're a success in every respect. You can live with a kind of self-deceit. But really, I am an okay person. I've got my act together. There's nothing wrong with me. Well, the Bible would insist there is. And unless we begin to feel that fundamental helplessness, powerlessness, which is ours by nature as human beings, we will never become believers in Jesus Christ. You will never become a Christian unless you're willing to acknowledge that fundamentally you are helpless. But that's our human condition. The leper and the centurion and his servant, even Peter's mother-in-law lying on her bed of sickness, they're models for us of the fact that all of us, by nature, are moral failures. Sickness and sin are linked, you see. And we can't do anything to get ourselves out of the mess. That brings me to the second thing, though, I want you to notice about the faith which these three demonstrate. The thing it has in common is its humble confidence in the power of Jesus. Notice, for instance, how this man with leprosy comes to Jesus. He came, we read in verse 2, and knelt before him, notice that, and says, Lord, notice that, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Now, I find a lot of people have a funny idea about faith. They have this idea that faith is a kind of spiritual energy which you have to work up in yourself and which has the power to do things. It's like a psychic force. It's like self-hypnosis. You know, if you can persuade yourself that such and such a thing is going to happen, it will happen. You get this kind of thing, don't you, in lots of New Agey kind of books these days. Visualize the thing you want and use the power of your imagination to acquire it. And a lot of people interpret faith in that way. They think that's what faith is, a kind of positive thinking. Now, well, it simply isn't like that. Look again at the way this man comes to Jesus. Think about it. He kneels before him. He says, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." There's great confidence in that prayer, isn't there? But not confidence in the proposition X is going to happen. This man is not whipping himself up into some self-hypnosis, saying, "I am going to get better." He's not standing in front of the mirror every day like that abbe in France in the last century encouraged his people to do, saying, "Every day in every way I'm feeling better and better." It's not that kind of nonsense, is it? The confidence this man has is in the person of Jesus. "If you want to, you can make me better." That's where his confidence lies. Not in the proposition X is going to happen, but in the power, the personal power of Jesus. He has become convinced of the authority of this man, Jesus. And because that power is located in such a person, he doesn't come aggressively, assertively, arrogantly. He doesn't try to manipulate this power of Jesus to do what he wants. He comes humbly. He comes as a beggar, kneeling before one he calls Lord, and says, "Lord, I've got no power at all, but you have. If you are willing, you can make me clean." There's no presumptuousness in that appeal, is there? There's not a demand there. The same, I think, is true of the centurion, isn't it? Look at the way he comes in verse 6. Again, notice what he says. "Lord, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering." Jesus said to him, "I will go and heal him." The centurion replies, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed." Now there's almost certainly a nuance in verse 7 which our translation has missed. If you look at the Greek text, you'll find that the "I" there, "I will go and heal him," is very emphatic. And I think the only way to make sense of that emphatic "I" is to put a question mark into verse 7. What Jesus is saying here is, are you asking me to come and heal him? Shall I come and heal him? Now, in the first century context, it's very easy to understand why Jesus should put the question that way. You see, this man was a Gentile. Jews never visited Gentile homes. It was absolutely unthinkable. It just wasn't allowed. You didn't do that sort of thing. For a holy Jew, in particular a rabbi, to think of doing something would be an admission of the most appalling defilement and compromise. So Jesus is here probing this Gentile's expectations and understanding. It's a teasing question. Are you asking me, a Jewish rabbi and teacher, to come to your house to heal your servant? Is that what you're asking? And how interesting is the reply, you see? Again, this interesting mix of confidence and humility. "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. But just say the word, and my servant will be healed." A man, as he tells us in verse 9, who understood authority. He lived with it every day. "Just say the word," he says. "I recognize the authority in you. I trust the authority you represent. I believe if you say he's going to be healed, it will be so. You don't need to come into my house. I know that's a problem for you. Just say the word. Confidence and humility, then. Humble confidence in the power of Jesus. That's what's characteristic of this faith that we're seeing demonstrated in these cases, in this chapter. And I think it's enormously important that we understand that, and that our mental picture of what faith is conditioned by those two words, confidence and humility. If you will, you can make me clean. Some of you may know that sometimes when somebody's sick, the counselling they receive in the Christian church doesn't conform to that model at all. It's much more like that New Age mind cure that I was referring to earlier. They'll tell you now, you've got to believe. You've got to believe that God's going to heal you. You've got to believe it. There's not going to be a shadow of doubt. If you can just whip up enough faith that God's going to heal you, you will be healed. And if you're not healed, it's because you haven't got enough faith. It's as simple as that. Haven't you heard counselling like that? It isn't biblical counselling. It isn't the way that Christians think about miracles. It isn't the way Christians seek healing. The way we seek healing is like this leper. Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. See, he has no doubt about the power of Jesus to heal him, but he refuses to be presumptuous about the purpose of Jesus. Same with the centurion. He realizes that he's coming here to one who has authority. He doesn't have the right to give this man orders. He can't pin his arm. He can't pin Jesus' arm behind his back and extricate a miracle from him. He's far too great a person for that. All he can do is beg that he will say the sovereign word. Now, supposing Jesus had said to either of these men, "No." Oh, it's perfectly true. I have the power to heal you of your leprosy. But my judgment is, for you it is better to remain a leper. I'm not going to heal you. Or suppose he had said to this centurion, "Yes, it's perfectly true. I've only to say the word and your servant will be healed. But in my discretion in this matter, I have decided not to do so in this case." Suppose he'd said that. I mean, do you think Jesus healed every single sick person in Israel? Do you think in the days of Jesus' public ministry there was no sickness in Israel? Do you think there were no funerals? No mourners during those 3 years of his public ministry because everybody was being cured all the time by Jesus? Do you think those healings in the Gospels are carte blanche for us to expect deliverance from every form of suffering and tragedy in our lives? Of course they're not. Jesus does not always work miracles the way we would like him to, even for those who have faith to recognize his hand at work and come to him in humble confidence. And the whole point about true faith is that it doesn't demand that he should. For true faith is not conditional faith. True faith is not, "I'll believe if." True faith is not saying, "You work a miracle, Jesus, and then I'll put my faith in you." True faith is a confession of humble confidence in the power of Jesus. And that means sometimes faith accepts the answer no, as well as the answer yes. What did this centurion go away with? With a miracle? No, he just went away with a word. Just a word, but it was enough. It satisfied him. It was the word of Jesus. In the same way, we must beware of becoming miracle hunters. They don't serve our faith, you know. The whole point of the Christian faith is that our relationship with this person of Jesus gets developed, gets strengthened. Christianity is not a kind of magic making supernatural things happen by the power of our faith. It's a personal response to this extraordinary and unique person who has come to us. Humble confidence in his power means that sometimes we will go to him with our problems, asking him to do something supernatural about them. But humble confidence in him will also mean that whether he says yes or no, we will be satisfied with the word he sends us away with. Do you notice, in that connection, the response which Jesus makes to each of these characters? I find it very touching. In fact, touching is the very word, isn't it? He touched the man, verse 3. And again in verse 14, Peter's mother-in-law, he touched her hand. Something very tender about that, isn't there? And in the case of the leper, I think something rather remarkable. How long do you think it had been since this leper had been touched by another human being? It's a thought, isn't it? Jesus here demonstrates an enormous compassion for people in their sickness and in their problems, in their social disadvantages and in their rejection by society. Of course, as a strict Jew obeying the law, he shouldn't have touched the leper at all. But he shows an indifference to those Jewish scruples here. He touches the leper. And in the case of the centurion, he does something even more remarkable. Do you see verses 10 and 11 and so on? I tell you the truth, he says to those around him. I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith as this centurion has. I say to you, many will come from the east and the west and will take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Do you know what that means? That means that Jesus thinks the centurion will go to heaven and that a lot of Jews won't. All the Jews in Jesus' day were looking forward to the coming of the kingdom. They had this great idea that the patriarchs, people like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, were all going to preside at a huge banquet and that all the Jewish people were going to be invited to join. And that all the Gentile people, all the non-Jews who had persecuted the Jews so much over the centuries, were all going to get their comeuppance from God, good and proper. That's the way they pictured heaven, so many of them anyway. Jesus is saying here, it won't be like that at all. On the contrary, some people who call themselves the subjects of the kingdom, the Jews, are going to be thrown outside into the darkness. Oh, he's not a universalist. He's not saying everybody's going to go to heaven. He's saying that some people who think they're going are mistaken. In particular, some self-righteous Jews who look down their noses at Roman centurions. Now, the subjects of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness, and they're going to feel so frustrated out there, weeping and gnashing their teeth. But there will be others from the east and the west, people, in other words, from Gentile nations, who will take their places at that great banquet with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. An extraordinary thing to say. Can you imagine the look on the faces of some of his fellow Jews when he should say such a thing? What does it mean? It means, you see, that for Jesus, keeping rules like don't touch a leper, don't go into a Gentile's house, etc., etc., keeping religious rules like that has nothing to do with whether you're going to heaven. The mark of a person who is really going to heaven is that they have faith in him. That's the key issue. That's what this centurion had. Indeed, Jesus says he hadn't found such a faith in all of Israel. What an irony. That was the key thing that would make it possible for this man to sit around that table. He was a believer for all his Gentile status. That's what mattered. Now, Jesus will say exactly the same for us. I don't know much about a lot of you here tonight. Some of you I know your faces, some of you I know personally, but there are others who are completely new to me. But it's quite possible there are all sorts of people here who feel like this leper did, like this centurion did. They feel like they have suffered from prejudice, suffered from disadvantage, or they've had to struggle through life to get where they've got. Maybe they feel they've suffered prejudice on grounds of race or colour, like that centurion. Maybe they feel they've suffered prejudice on grounds of sex or sexual orientation. Maybe they feel they've suffered prejudice because they've suffered from a mental illness or they're handicapped in some way or they come from a poor background. All sorts of reasons why people feel disadvantaged, shut out, socially rejected, not worth anything. Well, I tell you this. When Jesus looks at us, right now, looks at this congregation, he doesn't divide us up on the basis of those kinds of class considerations. Yeah. This one's such and such a race, this one's such and such a sex, this one's such and such a mess, this one's handicapped, this one's poor, etc. He doesn't see those distinctions between us at all. He sees only two categories. There are people who have humble confidence in him, and there are other people who don't. And he says to the former category, they will sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And he says to the latter category, they will be thrown outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. If you don't like that division, you better argue with Jesus about it. That's how he sees things. That's why faith is so important. Humble confidence in him, personally. And that brings me to the third thing I want you to notice about these cases that are here in Matthew 8. Each of them, in their believing, is making an acknowledgement of their own personal powerlessness and helplessness. Each of them, in their believing, is making a confession of humble confidence in Jesus. And each of them, in believing, finds themselves commissioned to some form of action, testimony, service. For instance, look at verse 14. I think this is why, or verse 15, I think this is why this little incident has been included, because of this little touch in the story. Jesus came into Peter's house. He saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. I think that's the reason that Matthew has included that little snippet, just for that sentence. There's nothing else particularly distinctive about the rest of the story, maybe, but there, she got up and began to wait on him. Immediately she's healed, she's involved in serving Jesus. There's something rather similar back in verse 4, isn't there, with the man who is cleansed from his leprosy. We'll see what Jesus says to him. See that you don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. On the surface, of course, it seems a little strange that Jesus should command the man to be silent. But actually, this is something we should discover Jesus does quite a bit in the Gospel. And almost certainly the reason is that he knew that popularity among the Galilean masses that was fostered simply by the reckless telling of stories of his miracles was going to do more harm than good. He wasn't interested in that kind of faith. A reputation for being a worker of wonders was not the kind of Messiah he had come to be. It would simply mislead and confuse people if that was the sort of reputation that went like fire around the neighborhood. So he tells this man, don't make a song and dance about it. Don't tell anyone. But instead, go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them. Now again, there's quite a lot of debate about why Jesus should make this a recommendation to the man. At the very least, what he's telling him to do is to go to his local community where he belongs, or where he originally belonged before he became a leper perhaps, and go through the procedure laid down in the Mosaic law for social rehabilitation. In the rare instance that someone with a disease that looked like leprosy, and perhaps had been misdiagnosed, got better, there was a provision in the law for such a person to be declared clean and readmitted into the Jewish community. And Jesus is saying, now you go to the priest and you take advantage of that. You don't have to be an outcast any longer. You don't have to go around shouting unclean, unclean any longer. You can become a member of ordinary human society again. Go and do it. Go and show yourself to the priest, offer the gift Moses commanded, and get involved again in normal life. But the interesting thing is that final phrase, isn't it? As a testimony to them. That could mean no more than, as a testimony, offer the sacrifice as a testimony that you have been cured, as evidence that you have been cured. But that word testimony is so often used in the New Testament of testimony of witness to Jesus. It's a little bit hard to believe that Matthew would have used that word in this context without having that at the back of his mind. So maybe what Jesus is actually saying here is something like this. Don't make a lot of fuss about what has happened here while I'm still around. That will cause trouble. But go back home, get yourself re-established in the community, and there, in that context, give your quiet witness to what I have done for you. I think that might be filled out what Jesus is actually saying, though I have to admit, it's a subject of controversy. But one thing I want you to notice, though, in the case of this leper, and indeed of all these cases, is that Jesus conspicuously avoids turning his miracles into a piece of theatre. I mean, if these miracles had been done by certain people in our contemporary religious world, they'd have had them up on a stage before tens of thousands, giving their testimony to how they were healed by the name of Jesus. Wouldn't they? Like some circus act, they would be exhibited and exploited. There is no such attention seeking here at all. Quite the opposite. In the case of the leper, he tells him to be quiet, and if he's going to make his testimony, go and make it somewhere back home, where people aren't going to get too excited about Jesus being there and then. In the case of the centurion, he doesn't even do the miracle on the spot. The centurion doesn't even discover that the miracle's happened till he gets home. And in the case of Peter's mother-in-law, it all happens in the little domestic environment of a home. In each case, there is service. There is testimony to bear. But it's not the exhibitionist testimony of the wonder worker. It's something much quieter, something much more domestic and demure and humble. But I suspect if we only understood the kind of faith that Jesus is really interested in discovering in human beings, far more effective and useful to him. Maybe somebody is saying to themselves tonight, well, I have learnt something about faith. I wish I had it. That's another thing I've heard people say to me at various times. Oh, Roy, I wish I had your faith. People said that to you if you're Christian. It's a very embarrassing thing to say because you wish you could tell them, oh, well, it's easy. You can have it. All you've got to do is... As you see, I don't know a formula like that. Do you, if you're honest? Maybe you came here tonight and you just said before you came in, well, if this guy Clements can work a miracle on the stage there tonight, I'll become a believer. Well, I'm sorry, I don't have that assurance at all, even if I had or could. I think you misunderstand your own heart and you misunderstand the nature of faith. You can't conditionalize faith like that. It's psychologically impossible. It's like a boy saying to a girl, if you do this or that, then I'm going to fall in love with you. It's nonsense. Love is a mysterious gift. It's not in my power to will it, unless I already, in some sense, have it. And it's the same with faith. It can't be self-manufactured. It is a gift. You can drown a person's mind with philosophical arguments. You can render them speechless with amazement with miracles. You can paralyze them with emotional ecstasy in worship meetings. But you cannot create real faith that way. You may create something that looks a bit like it for a week or two. The people who say, I'll believe if God does this or that, if he meets my conditions, they are deluding themselves. It isn't like that. So you want to tell me, well, or say to me, well, how do I get this faith? Willingness to acknowledge your helplessness, this deep sense of how powerless you are as a human being, it will be yours. You'll find this humble confidence in the person of Jesus. It will be yours. You'll find this sense of commissioning to go out and be a testimony to Jesus and to serve him. It will be yours. This faith that we see exemplified in these three stories, it will be yours. Just do A, B, and C. I wish I could tell you a formula that would lead you inevitably, infallibly, down that road. If I could, I tell you, I would be telling everybody. In fact, this church would not be holding 500 people tonight. It would be holding several thousand. If such a formula existed, I'd have converted the whole country by now. But you see, it doesn't. It isn't like that. There is something mysterious about this faith. You don't get it just by seeing a miracle. Actually, the faith itself is a miracle. But people do get it. Strangely, mysteriously, yeah, supernaturally. When they're reading this book, when they're listening to their Christian friends talking to them about Jesus, when they're hearing preachers like me sometimes from the pulpit, sometimes when they're present at a baptismal service, which we're going to see in just a moment. It happens to people. They find, when they consult their hearts at the deepest level of their honesty, that they do believe. They didn't make themselves believe. It wasn't that God fulfilled some condition they had laid down and now they've agreed to do it. They find themselves believing. They find themselves believing. I don't know how it happens. I wish I did. It happened to Simon Peter once. Jesus said to him, "You are blessed, Simon Peter. Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Nothing would delight my soul more than to know that you'd made that discovery when you consulted your heart at the deepest level of honesty. You would have to say, yes, it's true. I know deep down I am helpless and powerless, and all my pretensions of being in charge of my life are a farce. Yes, it's true. I do think Jesus is utterly special and unique. And I am willing and able to put my confidence in him as my Savior." And I will step out of this place, therefore, tonight, determined to serve him and be a testimony for him. Let's pray together.